Okay, I'll say good evening. This is K2KEY.
Good evening, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW. Do we have any other check-ins tonight?
KC2UPP, Mike, and yes.
Mike, we got you. Anyone else?
November 2, Alpha, Japan. No traffic.
This is WS2N. Name here is Paul, and no questions.
Very fine. AJ and Paul. Anyone else? Okay, let's start off with Mike. KC2, Uncle Papa Papa. K2RIW, you got it, Mike.
I want to say good evening to everybody. I'm very new to amateur radio. I just started, I guess it's... Able to do the splits. My question is what type of equipment do you need, such as antennas, and maybe what kind of wattage should you be putting out while trying to contact the space station?
Okay, good set of questions. The AMSAT, if I remember correctly, they used to recommend 10 watts of output power into a reasonable antenna, which I think was something like a four-element Yagi that could be aimed at the satellite. There were satellite tracking programs so that the antenna would follow the satellite. That's one approach. There are people who use a broadband antenna, like, say, for instance, a ground plane with tilted radials so that it covers most of the hemisphere, the upper hemisphere of the sky, with the exception of right at the zenith point, straight up. It wouldn't cover that so well. Since very few of the passes go directly overhead, that's not a great disadvantage. So in the old days, something like 10 watts of radiated power was considered the right amount, because some of the satellites were on a power-shared basis. In other words, there's a given amount of downlink power coming out of the satellite, and some of them had a broadband input where multiple people could talk through the satellite simultaneously, as long as no one person captured all the power by running too high a power at the input. So 10 watts of uplink power was the recommendation at that time. I haven't used AMSAT satellites for quite a few years, and so with the later birds, some of that may have changed. In the case of the International Space Station, very similar to talking to the space shuttle, which I did way back in, I think it was 1986. There, the actual power required to get from ground to satellite, 1 watt will do it, believe it or not, because you've got direct line of sight. If you calculate the numbers, let me drop. If you calculate the numbers of power output of a handy talkie, let's say 3 watts into a rubber duck, and if the space shuttle is within line of sight of you because it flies at something like 150 nautical miles of altitude, which means you do have line of sight to it to about 1,500 miles. 1,500 miles, handy-talkie, line of sight should give a signal that's got 15 or so dB of carrier-to-noise ratio, which is close to dead full quieting. I know that whenever you use a handy-talkie, talking to another person with a handy-talkie, when you talk a mile away, you feel reasonably satisfied. And here I am talking about 1,500 miles, and the big difference, of course, is line of sight. When you're talking to the shuttle at that high an altitude, you've got direct line of sight, most of the time nothing in between. So if you were talking to the satellite all by yourself, as, say, for instance, King Hussein did way back in 1985, a couple of watts of uplink power is all that's required. The problem is that when you're talking to the International Space Station, or the space shuttle, there's probably a number of other people on the channel trying to do the same thing with you. And in which case, it's not whether or not your signal is strong enough to be heard. Now the problem is the QR Mary of your fellow amateurs. Is your signal strong enough to be heard above the other amateurs who are talking at the same time? When the satellite flies, when the space shuttle or International Space Station flies over the United States, if he's got 1,500-mile radius from the satellite to the horizon, You can see that he's really looking at a 3,000-mile diameter of humanity all at once, and there's an awful lot of amateurs in that particular volume, and therefore, whether or not your signal is strong enough compared to the others makes the difference between a QSO and a non-QSO. So the guys who get through, unfortunately, have to run some pretty high power to climb above the crowd. But when it comes to AMSAT satellite work, a rather low amount of power can do it. What is the recommendation? Let me drop. The recommendation is you should have a system where you can hear yourself in the downlink at the same time you're talking to the uplink. And that way you stand a chance of adjusting your power accordingly. Well, there's a catch with that one, and that is, if your particular receiving setup didn't have enough sensitivity, or if you had a lot of local noise, or you didn't have a low enough noise figure of your receiver system, or enough gain in the receiver listening to the downlink, you might have trouble hearing the output from the satellite. Therefore, you would be increasing your power in the uplink in order for you to be able to hear yourself, and you might go above the linear power, so to speak, which is around 10 watts, and therefore you capture the satellite, and every bit of its power output is from you because you're overloading the input, so to speak. And so people who run into that particular problem where they want to hear themselves coming back, but their receiving system is marginal, and as such, they don't adjust the power output accordingly. Now, let's see, WV2U just mailed me a very nice email on AMSAT. There is a AMSAT bulletin you can get, AMSAT 095. It's a weekly bulletin which I think is applied, you can get free of charge. And there's a website you can go to in which you can read some of this information. There's a whole lot of literature you can get from AMSAT in which a lot more information can be had. I'm just scratching the surface. But that's one of one of the modes that's an awful lot of fun to use in ham radio, as I see it, Mike. You might really enjoy it. Sounds like you've done some listening already. Maybe you haven't talked through the actual bird yet. Drag your feet. Let the machine completely drop for two reasons. One, there are people out of the area who might want to check in, and until the machine thoroughly drops for a couple of seconds, they don't get a chance to do that. And second of all, I'd like to believe there are people using the AMSAT satellite within a sound of my voice right now, which have a lot more knowledge about it than I do. I haven't used it in quite a few years, as you can tell. So KC2, Uncle Papa Papa, with quite a bit of delay, K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay, looks like no one else has any information to give us right now, and we don't have any check-ins from the Internet. You've got it, Steve.
My name is Mike. Okay, well, I appreciate the information. I have been doing a lot of listening. I haven't been able to get through, but you give me some good information, and I'll try to make those adjustments. Thank you very much. KC2UPP out.
Yeah, sorry about that, Mike. I called you Steve by mistake. Mike, tell me what you've used for an antenna so far and what you've used for a receiver so far. And do you have a way of aiming it? Because the one of the AMSAT satellites at its apogee moves so slowly, you could go out in the backyard every half hour or 45 minutes and reorient the antenna and keep up with it manually, so to speak, as opposed to having a real azimuth and elevation motor. So which satellites have you heard to so far, and what equipment have you used, Mike? KC2UPP, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Well, I have a vertical antenna, which I know is not the best. But I have listened to the crew on the International Space Station. They come in very clearly, almost like they're, right on top of me. And I start picking them up about like you said, about 1,500 miles out. Some days better than others. They have a repeater on the International Space Station on another split frequency that I have been able to pick up some traffic, nearby, New England mostly. So it's been the space station, and AO51 is a pretty good one. I usually hear some traffic on that, but haven't been able to contact anybody. I'm using a Yaesu 7800 dual band, and I have, you know, split set up. Usually it's on 440 is downlink, and the uplink is on 2 meter. But that's my setup right now. I guess I need to get some kind of an antenna that I can point over.
Yeah, I think that is the recommendation, a pointable antenna setup. When you listen to the 440 downlink, was that also with a simple vertical antenna? And what were you using as the uplink 2-meter antenna? Was that also a vertical mic? Go ahead.
Yes, it's one antenna, dual band, antenna on my roof, about 18 feet, I guess, off the roof, about 40 feet in the air. Over.
Off your roof and 40 feet in the air. Good numbers. A nice altitude. Yeah, an aimable antenna, which has got a little bit more gain to it, could give you better response. And whether or not the antenna has to be circular polarized, that's another thing that you'll have to do some checking on. By way of the AMSAT news service, once you sign up to that, let's see now if I've got... Yeah. If you go to AMSAT news service, ans@amsat.org, ans@amsat.org, I think you will get some of the information you're looking for if you haven't already done that. I know that there's a lot of information available from AMSAT as to the recommended antenna and recommended power output for each of the satellites that you might want to communicate with. As you find out more about this, because as you can tell, I'm a little bit light on this information, Mike, as you find out more about how to do it and whether you're successful or unsuccessful, doesn't matter, please come back in future weeks and let us know what you discovered, what has worked, and what doesn't work. So we'd like to hear from you more about this particular project, Mike. Good luck with that, and please let us know what you discover. Let's see now. We have no other people at this time who have signed in who have said they've got a question. Let's open it up and find out, is there anyone else with a question for the TechNet? Give me your call then as a name at this time. K2RIW listening. And maybe the answer is no. Paul, WS2N, try to come up with a question. But if you can't, you might also tell us what has been happening in space. I don't remember which satellite did I hear about being launched recently. I know there's a launch coming up for Hubble repair. A launch has taken place when it comes to a device for looking for exoplanets, which hopefully is going through its early ring out of its hardware. So please bring us up to speed as to what's been happening in space, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. Well, the Kepler, yeah, that was launched. But it's going to take, 2 months, 60 days before that goes through its trial phase, you know, line everything, see if that thing could bring back the accurate information that they're looking for. After 2 months, they'll put that into operation. That's the one that's going to drift about a million miles behind the Earth. And then as time goes on, it's going to drift even further. You're going to have it many, many million miles behind the Earth. I think over a 3 or 4 year period, time is going to drift, maybe a quarter of a way around the circular path of the Earth, and that's the life expectancy of the operation of Kepler. And they plan on using photo detectors, not really optical, photo detectors to detect the light coming off the sun, all the different stars off their suns, to see if there's any dimming effect. If there's a dimming effect, that means there's a planet crossing in front of it. And 4 or 5 years from now, you might find 100 small planets equivalent to the size of Earth in the so-called Goldilocks zone. So that's an interesting mission. A lot of astronomers are very interested in that particular mission. That's one of the goals, try to find a planet that would be suitable for life as we know it, and then maybe in the future dipping arrays to pick up the possible transmissions from those. Signal reports. Likewise, on the other side of the pond, and a week from now, those couple of trees in front of my antenna will be gone. So I kind of like consider it the ultimate test. Question always comes up: do trees really affect the VHF frequency? You know, I've heard that many times on this net. I'm not even going to move my beam right now. I'm coming in on the input because I don't want to point this thing west to go on. Let me put it this way. No, I'm coming in through the Selvin repeater, let me put it that way, instead of going directly, which I normally do, to the North Shore Towers. So I'm not even going to touch this antenna for a week. When the trees are gone, I'm going to get different reports. Now, many times, let me drop it. Many times the propagation is different. Sometimes, you know, these guys come in at a 2 or a 3, and then other times they're down at a 1, or you don't even see an S meter, and you still copy them. So I'll let it go for about 3 or 4 weeks, try to get a good determination of whether or not there's really a difference with two 40-foot oak trees, one of them being maybe 20 feet in front of the antenna, and the other one about 40 feet in front of the antenna. I was wondering what you thought about that, Dick. What do you think the outcome is, of this experiment is going to be? Whether or not it makes a difference, we're going to find out anyway. My guess is maybe not much of a difference, but on a VHF 2 meter frequency. Back to you, Dick.
I ran an experiment. Let me let the machine drop just to make sure that anyone who wants to check in gets a chance to do so. WO2Z.
Go check it in.
I think I heard WO2Z, and who was the other person?
November 2, Victor United Geneva, Frank and Holbrook.
Okay, Frank and Holbrook. And WO2Z, what is your name and location?
It's William Ocean to Zulu. Name is Ian, and I'm in Uniondale.
Okay. Let me make sure now that I know. Ian, you do have a question. You want to be on that list?
That's correct.
And Victor, uniform, I think that's Frank in Holbrook. You want to be on the list also?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay. Very good. To get back to Paul's original question, I was also very curious about foliage attenuation, Paul, back in the mid-70s when I was pretty heavily enthusiastic about 432 megacycles. So I had calibrated my receiver system, and I was giving everybody I talked to, the 400 guys I talked to on 432 around that time, I kept a 3x5 card for each one of these guys, and I would write down their signal strength in microvolts. I had calibrated my receiver in microvolts, and I would tell them how many microvolts they're giving me today. And as I look back over those records, it was obvious to me that the guys on 432 whose antennas were high enough to clear the trees, they gave me almost the same number of microvolts, summer, winter, spring, fall, rainy, not rainy, whatever. Very little difference. Some propagation differences from day to day, but for each of those seasons, and rain or not rain, and water on the trees, their signal strength averaged very close to the same numbers. For the guys, though, whose antennas were below the trees on 432, winter was quite a bit stronger than summer. The foliage on the trees attenuated the signal quite a bit, and on a rainy day, when the leaves were wet and they had to transmit through them, I saw numbers like at least 15 or 20 dB of difference in signal strength. Of course, weaker signal strength on a rainy day in the summertime when the antenna was below the tree line. Now, of course, there's a lot of variables involved here, and that is a guy looking through a couple of trees on his property, or is he looking through a mile of trees before the signal gets free and out into the air? There's a lot of variables along those lines. Also, if I'm talking to somebody on Long Island who's looking through trees versus talking to somebody in Maryland who's looking through trees, was there a difference there? In the case of the guy from Maryland, for instance, his signal had a lot of different ways of getting out of his neighborhood into mine, and the difference in signal strength was a little bit more difficult to track. Not only was there a lot more propagation difference over those few hundred miles between us, but second of all, because of multiple ways the signal could get there when there's not much difference in between. So that's what I saw on 432. It is my belief your
repeater, time out.
It is my belief you're going to see less of that effect on 2 meters. If, for instance, you ran that experiment of an antenna that cleared the trees and didn't clear the trees, and you did the experiment at, say, 20 meters, you would see a difference in signal strength because of the altitude of the antenna, how far above the ground. But whether or not it cleared the trees for a given altitude, the trees on 20 meters are 98% transparent, in my opinion. And what's going on here is that the wavelength is so big compared to the size of the actual attenuating devices, the leaves and branches and so on, that on 20 meters you're going to see very little attenuation. On 432, where the wavelength is roughly 2 feet, the leaves are now becoming a significant portion of that wavelength. 2 meters, you're going to be getting a lot less of that effect. So, depending on whether you do that experiment on 2 meters or 432, you're going to get different results, in my opinion. It's a good experiment to do. So, good luck with that. Okay, I'm trying to remember now who signed in first. I guess it was Ian. W-O-2-Z, I think it is Ian. Go right ahead with your question. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Dick, by the way, no leaves.
Yeah,
we don't have any leaves
yet.
The trees are gone. That's the only factor.
Recently got into, I guess, home brewing and rebuilding or restoring HF amplifiers. And my question's related to power display transformers. From what I can tell, there are CCS and ICAS. I was wondering for the ICAS, if you have a transformer that's rated for a certain CCS, what could you expect percentage-wise an increase in amperage out of that transformer on ICAS type service?
Okay, and one of the variables, believe it or not, Ian, is are you running at the 100-watt level or the 1,000-watt level? First of all, what power of amplifier is that plate transformer feeding? Go ahead, Ian.
Okay, it's probably going to be doing somewhere in the vicinity of 3,000 volts at most 1 amp.
Okay, we're talking about kilowatt-type power supplies. And when it comes to a kilowatt amplifier, the article I wrote on that subject way back in 1972, I supplied a schematic diagram of a power supply for the amplifier, as well as the actual tube set up for the strip line amplifier itself. This was a 432 megacycle parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432 megacycles. In that case, the biggest difference as to how much heating you get in the power transformer, the biggest difference is whether or not the transformer is feeding a choke input filter network or a capacitor input filter network. In each case, you might want close to the same number of volts of output, the same number of amperes. In the case of a capacitor input filter network, after the rectifier from the transformer, you make the capacitors big enough so that you get very little ripple. That's the good news. The bad news is that the current only flows from the transformer through the rectifying diode into those capacitors for only a small number of degrees of the actual 360 degree cycle, the full 60 cycle power. and as such, the current pulses become much larger than the average current. If, for instance, you're getting 1 ampere of output, those pulses coming out of the rectifier network with a capacitor input might be 10 amperes of peak current in spikes that are only there for 5 or 10% of the time. Because the heating of the transformer wiring is a function of I squared R, that's the way you calculate the heat you get across a resistor, current squared times the resistance in ohms, you get with capacitor input network, you could easily get 10 times the current, 10 times the heating characteristic. I found this out in the process of building that amplifier. Let me drop. In the process of building that amplifier, I had burned up a couple of power transformers where I thought I was using them at the continuous commercial service rating. Well, the continuous commercial service rating was for a choke input supply. And so unless your particular manufacturer of your transformer has told you that that particular rating is for a capacitor input, not a choke input, there's a very big variable there. Under normal circumstances, intermittent commercial amateur service, because the average amateur, he's talking half the time and listening half the time, you get not quite but close to a 2-to-1 difference in current rating capability if it was choke input. Now, if you had a choke input rectifier network, there the current output from the transformer is almost continuous across the whole cycle, whereas with capacitor input it comes in very brief spikes. So there's really the biggest variable, more than ICAS rating than CCS rating. Now, what I just said doesn't completely solve the problem. You might decide that you want to use a choke input supply, which makes the power supply run colder, more efficiently, and lesser, smaller current spikes out of the transformer and rectifier network, and therefore much safer heating of the transformer itself. You might decide that you want to run choke input, and the problem is that you have to start off with a higher voltage for choke input out of the secondary winding of the transformer than you do with capacitor input. And the difference is, let me think now, the capacitor input type is looking at the peak voltage coming out of the transformer. The choke input type rectifier network is looking at the average. Average voltage is 63% of peak. So my guess is there's a, it's not quite that big a ratio. It's probably a, I'm guessing it's close to 63%. You'd have to have a considerably higher voltage out of the transformer in order to run choke input and still get the same rectified voltage, filtered voltage, out of the power supply. Unless you've got a whole lot of extra turns ratios on the transformer primary, that could represent a little bit of a problem. Let's see if other people listening to my voice have got comments on this particular subject.
Repeater, timeout.
Yes. K-E-Y.
Yeah, Mel's got a question, a comment. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, well, this is K2KEY. The whole problem, of course, with power transformers, which was the destroyer of power transformers, is what is known as core saturation. You know, it changes once you get this core saturation. It does mess up the permeability, and that could create the heating. One of the factors that many times we look at the design that looks really well is non-linearity that develops causing core saturation. Of course, another problem, harmonics or distortion products, puts a terrific strain on sometimes on the transformers. So there have been designs of newer transformers in the last few years, such as that were marketed, so that they are actually multi-core type designs, and they seem to be able to stand the undesirable conditions a lot easier, Dick, over.
Okay, Mel, if a transformer manufacturer did a good design, and if he has rated the primary winding for 240 volts, and if if you're feeding at 240 volts, I'd like to believe that his design is such that the core is not going into saturation. You do saturate the core if there are not enough turns in the primary winding of the transformer. Or, for instance, if you've got a whole lot of voltage taps and you're using one of the very low voltage taps, but you're putting high voltage in it because you want more voltage out of it. There's where I think you're discussing the problem, where if a guy had a transformer that doesn't give him quite enough voltage for his, let's say, a choke input rectifier network and filter network, and therefore he puts 220 volts across the primary, but he's putting it on the 200 volt winding tap as opposed to the 240 that he's supplying, so to speak, and he could be saturating the core. So if you're feeding the proper voltage to the particular primary winding, I'd like to believe you would not run into core saturation. There are people who believe that the core will saturate more rapidly if you put the secondary winding under a heavy load. And I think it actually works the other way around. As you start loading down the secondary, you're going to create heating of the wiring. The primary and secondary wire is going to get some I squared R heating. But the actual saturation of the core might decrease because of the primary voltage drop when you put the secondary under a heavy load. I'm going to send it back to you, Mel, for some comments on that one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger. Well, you see, the transformers, of course, as you buy them, they always had the specification on them, CCS, Continuous Commercial Service, and ICAS, Intermittent Commercial Amateur Service. And the difference could be considerable, because you take that amplifier and you run it on sideband, you're okay. You can usually, get away with it, no problem. You take that same amplifier, decide to use it on RTTY or slow scan or FM, and you could run into a heck of a lot of problems. So you've got to look at that rating whether it's CCS or ICAS, and know what you're going to put the transformer, what the amplifier is going to be used for, so you know if it's got the appropriate transformer in it, Dick, over.
Hey, you brought up a couple of very good points there, Mel. First of all, a sideband transmitter, except for the little bit of bias current of the final stage to try to create some extra linearity, crossover distortion linearity, except for the bias current, your transmitter final stage draws very little current until you speak into the microphone. And then you're putting out power and you're drawing current. So depending on how much speech processing you're doing, depending on how many pauses there are between your words, I'll bet you could easily double the current rating of a transformer in sideband service compared to its CCS rating. But not counting the sideband phenomena. Still, intermittent commercial amateur service, where we talk for a couple of minutes and then listen for a couple of minutes, is a typical operation. What's your guess, Mel, as to what is the difference between the CCS rating and the ICS rating? If I understood Ian correctly, he knew the CCS rating of his transformer. It does not have a ICAS rating stamped on it. So, not counting the sideband phenomena, I am guessing at least a 50% increase is capable for ICAS versus CCS. That's my first guess. And then when he adds the sideband characteristic to it altogether, I think we're talking about almost a 2-to-1 difference in current capability of the transformer. You might have an opinion on that one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than first beats the eye. The maximum rated value should never be exceeded under any circumstances. For instance, let's take a power transformer like I've used, you use, about 2,500 volts, plate current somewhere, maximum supposedly around 500 milliamps. The tubes have a dissipation, usually in amateur service, somewhere in that class around 350 watts. Now, if you take that 2,500 volts, and you said, well, I'll multiply it by the 500 mils, the rating, I should be getting 1,250 watts. Now, this is only really comes into effect if this is not exceeded. If the tube, you know, used as, let's say, in sideband using class C. Now, it's another thing we got into understanding. Class of operation, AB2, for instance, sideband, with efficiency of 60% approximately in AB2. So then, if we work out the formula and see that theoretically 1,250 watts, 60%, what are we getting down to? About 800, what, 850, 870 watts or so. Over.
Yeah, Ian did say he's trying to make 3,000 volts at 1 ampere for his particular tubes. As you can tell, Ian, we don't have a good, hard answer for you. Without a doubt, ICAS rating is higher than CCS, and if you're building the transmitter for sideband service, which means that it only is putting out power when you speak into the microphone, that helps a lot. You might want to do a little bit more research of your particular brand name and model number of transformer, even though it doesn't have an ICAS rating. If the CCS rating is 1 ampere, I think you're pretty safe. But by going back to the manufacturer or doing a web search or finding maybe there's a site where guys have really rated the ICS ratings of particular well-known transformers, you'd be able to find out a little bit further. But as I said before, a big variable as to how much the transformer can take. Because when you put a transformer under heavy load, believe it or not, the magnetic core of the transformer actually becomes loaded less, and the core itself runs a little bit colder when you put the transformer under heavy load. Of course, that sounds crazy. What's really happening when you put it under heavy load is that the heat generated in the primary winding wiring itself, and the heat generated in the secondary winding wiring itself, that's where the real heat comes from, and most transformers fail due to overheating. Almost never do they fail from a voltage breakdown because, if anything, you're limiting the high voltage by putting it under load, if you know what I mean. So by monitoring the temperature of the transformer under your particular service, you can get a clue as to what its life will be. There's quite a few different ways you can find out whether or not your particular service is proper for your particular transformer. And if at worst the transformer does fail, it's not the end of the world. I've been through that cycle, and there are various ways you can get a substitute transformer and replace the one that failed. I know you haven't had a complete answer. At least you know a little bit more of the variables involved, and maybe you've got some further questions here, Ian. WO2Z, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
One more thing, K2KY.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, the rule of thumb always has been, for instance, as that transformer I just described, around 2,500 volts, 500 mil, running in sideband AB2, 60% efficiency. In other words, if you took this setup and you ran the current to the limited state, about 350 milliamps, like I say, with a transformer that's rated at 500, 60%, you would most likely never have any kind of failure, Dick, over. And that's in ICAS, which is that is what all the transformers that you get, you buy your amplifier, that's what they are rated as in ICAS. CCS transformers, are much more expensive, much larger and everything. And I don't know maybe sometimes, homebrewing will go ahead and buy a device like that, but they are extremely costly. Power transformers have gone off the deep end, as you well know. There's not too many availabilities for them anymore. And you will, as they say, taste through the nose today for a big transformer, over.
Yep, I agree with that. And I think Ian did say that his transformer already is CCS rated. And maybe he said he wants an ampere of output. Let's hope the transformer is rated for something like an ampere. So give us a little more information about this, Ian. WO2Z, K2RIW.
W. K2RIW.
W02Z and Mel. I have another question I'd like to direct to Mel, maybe a little related to particular tube, which I know he's experimented with, and you probably have had some experience with too. The transformer I was looking at was rated at CCS 600 mils, and the tube, the largest tube that I'm looking at experimenting with, and I've been playing with 3CX800s, 3-500s, and now 8877 that I like to play around with. That transformer is rated at, I think, somewhere around 3,000 volts at 600 mil CCS. And I think with the 8877, you could actually run above the 600 mil rating. Could be wrong. I wanted to stay away from the choke input because, you know, that added more parts, more complexity, as opposed to just the capacitance input. And with the Varis tubes, I also have a variac that I was going to vary the input voltage. So it's, I think that transformer is rated at 220 or 240 volts. And I was going to vary that. That would give me some variation on the output, the secondary voltage.
Okay, go ahead, Eric. We're going to pick up Eric and then Mel in that order. Eric, you got it.
I think you guys should let the folks out there know what ICAS and CCS stand for. But when are you guys going to get out of the Stone Age and start using this? A lot of actually commercially available, not very expensive, switching supplies that work very, very well. And actually, building them is not such a magic feat. It's actually not that hard anymore. It used to be. But, and by the way, I've got a bunch of 8877s, and they're pretty hard tubes to kill. Although, they're not, you know, they really don't like making one heck of a lot of output, but they're hard to die. No?
Okay, we did earlier say that CCS is Continuous Commercial Service, and ICAS stands for Intermittent Commercial Amateur Service. I see a C, Intermittent Commercial Amateur Service. How about that? Now, you're a strong advocate of switching type power supplies. And when it comes to a 12-volt, 24-volt, 40-volt power supply, I'm going to be in agreement with you. Let me ask you this, though, Eric. How many 3,000-volt, half-ampere class switching power supply ham radio articles have you seen in the last year? KE2VJ, K2RIW?
Two, actually. One in QEX, and I think it was the mention of another one in QSD. But I've been dealing with them for, you know, I use switches for my ion supplies and stuff like that. I mean, you know, companies like Stelman and a few others, they've been making them for years. Most people aren't aware of it. Actually, the ion supply is a little bit of a jiff because that only needs microamps, so that's actually a very, very tiny supply. But then I have some other ones that produce a half an amp. And I have two amps at 6,000 volts, 4,000 volts for various other purposes in the transmitter. So it's not an unusual thing, but there was somebody that took a Heath kit, got rid of the high voltage supply in there, put in a commercial switcher that somebody is actually selling for amateur service, and took a lot of pounds off.
Yeah, because the switcher was probably running at something like 100 kilohertz instead of 60 cycles, so an awful lot of iron is no longer required for either the choking or the transformering. But still, for a person who doesn't have a fair amount of construction skill, kilowatt level switching power supply strikes me as a bit of an unusual experiment. It's a rather advanced experiment for a home builder. For a person like yourself with 25 years experience, 35 years experience in electronics, you consider it easy. Picture a guy who has gotten into ham radio 1 year ago. Would you still recommend that he go into that enthusiastic a first construction project, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Sure.
K2IW, KE2EJ, look, how many Tesla coils have you built in your life? But we're not even talking about something of that nature. If you're going to build a linear high voltage supply, you know damn well you're going to be building stacks of diodes. And you know what? When you build it out of a switcher or you build it out of a big-ass transformer, you're still going to be putting a stack together. Actually, when you do it with a switcher that's running at about 60 kilohertz, there's a lot less that you have to deal with in terms of filtering. But, you know, the values of the capacitors and high voltage supplies are not terribly big to start with. So, yeah, okay, there's more complexity in terms of you have a transformer or you have a huge toroid which has some electronics behind it, but it's not as bad as you think.
Okay, that's his opinion. Mel, as you can tell, Ian wants to know about the 8877 tubes, 3CX800s, and he mentioned another tube in there. Ganshi, you've got some opinions on all of this. And I suspect, Mel, of your kilowatt amplifiers, I'll bet very few of them have a switching power supply. I think you're more of a traditional guy. I'll bet you've got a typical four-way rectified 60-cycle type power supply. That's my guess. K2KE1, K2RIW.
Yeah, roger, roger. I guess we're from the old school six. And, I got a number of amplifiers, a few commercial ones. Collins, very well constructed, using, you know, 3CX1500 and the 4CX1500 tube. And, homebrew amplifiers, what I did really got involved with some years ago was the 3CX800 came, you know, out on the market. iMac was very nice to offer 3CX800. If you bought one with the chimney and the socket, they gave you the other one for half price. So I went ahead and I bought a pair. I built the amplifier, and I rebuilt the amplifiers. I've had, you know, this amplifier, some of my amplifiers have gone through, and let's put it this way, many changes over the years. They went from way back, old bottle, you know, World War II vintage, like 4-125, 4-250, 8-13s, and all that kind of series. And then when the ceramic tubes came along, I started getting into them. So as far as working with, a little bit more modern design, switching power supply, I guess I can't see, really anything wrong with it. But I would say, I would disagree with Eric, and I think for the average home brewer still, the cut and dry method of power transformers, plate transformers, you know, the whole business, and standard procedures that we've used for years, I guess, are still fairly popular, Dick, over.
Okay, I'm trying to give a long enough period of time in case somebody wants to join us. As you can see, Eric, there's two old fogies here and one modern guy. You're a switching power supply enthusiast, and Mel and I, when it comes to 3,000 volt type power supplies, I'm a little more of the traditional kind. I think the parts are a little bit less expensive, a little bit easier to find. When it comes to the rectifier network, I'll admit they look rather similar. The advantage you've got with a switching supply is you need a lot less microfarads in the filtering. The transformer is a lot more compact, nowhere near as many pounds of iron, although that particular transformer is a little bit more exotic, a little bit more difficult to buy, I think. Also, when it comes to the raw voltage that runs the switching devices, I presume you're talking about using a rectifier directly off the 240 volt line, or the 120 volt line, but the 240 volt line, and that goes into a filter network, and you've got to be a little bit careful with the inrush current control there. That's got to be some kind of a startup resistor, because the worst case situation on many of these power supplies is that if you turn on the power supply at the instant that Con Ed is at the peak voltage, and you've got uncharged capacitors, that inrush current can be a fierce number. So that switching...
The coil saturates.
Okay. you say the core such, if it's a conventional rectifier network, the transformer gives you a significant series resistance equivalent, which limits the inrush current. If I'm running a switching regulator, and my first input rectifier from the ConEd line runs into filtering into a raw filter capacitor that runs the switching transistors, that inrush current is something that's got to be controlled. Let's hear a couple of words on this subject, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. And I have all the supplies that I'm familiar with. There's two things that go on. The core itself of the toroid saturates, so the amount of EMF that's being generated by the switcher itself, there's a limit to how what you do is it's sort of a stepped-out circuit in the front, where they run the thing slowly at first. They allow the core to get saturated. It starts to fill capacitors. And then they turn the rest of it on. They usually take the line voltage and double it, and that's what runs the switching transistors. And then there's, I think, two chips that are pretty much dedicated to, just pulse width modulators. It starts out as a very narrow pulse. As the step start circuit brings it up, then it becomes, 50-60% duty cycle, and there, it actually regulates very well. But the way that the design, the way that the ICs that are available for it are smart about it, so you don't have you still have to do a step start like you would with a regular high voltage supply, and in my case, like in the big transmitter, there's some huge resistors that get popped in via relays, believe it or not. It's the most amazing thing you've ever seen, but that's how they do it. K2IW, K2EJ.
KC2, QIQ.
Okay, Glenn recognized. I'm going to go to you in a second. Ian's going to be getting a lot of information from various people here. QIQ. Make sure I write it down so I don't forget who's going to get the comment next. Yeah, at first, Eric, you were talking about the pulse width modulation control, in other words, a low duty cycle at first to charge the output filter network. But the real inrush current on the input rectifier network is the one that I'm concerned about. You do it with a big dropping resistor and a relay that gets that bypasses that when those capacitors are at full steam. The voltage doubler on the input, and I guess you're starting off with 240 and voltage doubling? Wow. 480 volts, and that's what you're running the switching transistors at? Those are pretty healthy devices. They're standing off 1,000 volts of peak inverse voltage. But I guess modern-day FETs maybe can do that. And again, maybe Glenn's got some opinions on this one, but you do have to worry about the inrush current. Let's see how Glenn handles that. KC2 QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net. But this is a common problem with just about any power supply. I'm kind of a switching power supply designer myself, and one of the things that always, the two things that you normally see on a lot of these power supplies are using the series resistor and relay, and basically, short out the relay after a period of time. Usually, half a line cycle to two line cycles. Certainly, you don't need more than that. So somewhere around 8 to 10 milliseconds of delay, and we close the relay. This way, most of that inrush current is gone. Or another nice method of doing it is to take a MOSFET and wire it in after the rectifier, and then put a small switching regulator on the MOSFET, where you put a timeout function. So you start off with a very, very narrow square wave pulse, and you increase the pulse width until it goes out the full duty cycle after a period of time. It also can be done with a 555 timer and a comparator and just a RC time constant on the other side of the comparator. So you allow the duty cycle of the output of that 555 timer that drives the MOSFET to time out. And basically it just allows the MOSFET to basically pump the square wave over time to limit the current into the inrush, into the input caps. Over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Letting it really drop just to make sure we're not leaving anybody out who might want to join us. Here's a man off the street, Glenn, KC2QIQ, who as an occupation designs and builds switching type regulators for firing up things like high efficiency light emitting diodes, and things like this. with your particular experience, Clint, if you wanted to inexpensively, rapidly, without too much grief, design a power supply for your ham radio transmitter, an HF transmitter that you're going to use on, let's say, 20 meters, using something like a 3CX800 tube, where you desire 3,000 volts at 600 milliamperes, or 500 milliamperes, in that neighborhood. If you wanted 3,000 volts at 500 milliamperes, and you wanted to do it inexpensively, rapidly, without too much grief, even with your experience, for your home operation, would you make that 2-kilowatt class power supply switching type or old-fashioned 60-cycle transformer type? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
That's a very good question. And for myself, I can say honestly, I usually don't take either of those approaches, but let me answer your question first. Basically, I would probably suggest going with the 60-cycle method and getting in contact with somebody like Inwood Transformer or somebody who builds large transformers in that area and work with them to come up with something that's going to give you the correct current and voltages that you're looking for and build it with rectifiers. The reasons I would probably steer people away isn't because I don't believe that they couldn't design the PWM and the other things. There's plenty of circuits out there you can do, ICs, drivers, all kinds of great things and rectifiers available to do it. The problem is they're going to have a lot of trouble with the transformer design, getting the coupling, the heating out of the transformer, and it may not be all that safe. The other problem that they're going to probably run into is a lot of noise problems. To keep the high-frequency rectifiers, even at 100 kilohertz, which isn't even all that high, but the EMI that's going to be generated, to really try to nail that down at 3,000 volts, probably is a task a little bit above the average amateur to really handle. Probably the more advanced operators that have been around a while and have already tackled a few power supplies here and there and are familiar with dampening EMI with a lot of experience in that area, that's probably more of a project for them, because I think the noise that would be generated from that power supply would be at 3,000 volts at 100K is probably a little bit more than the average amateur wants to handle. I also have a better approach to that, Dick, if you're interested, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, so far, it is 3-1. Mel, Dick, and Glenn, for a recently licensed amateur, would probably recommend old-fashioned type power supply. Whereas Eric, a much more modern guy, is saying, this guy should immediately go over to switching type. Switching type for 12 volts, beautiful. But for 3,000 volts at half an ampere, that's an unusual set of circumstances. The DVDT, the change in voltage versus time, on the secondary winding of that transformer, which is creating 60 kilohertz square waves at the 3,000 volt rating, we're talking about a zillion volts per microsecond here. You've got to be careful on the way you choose those particular rectifiers that are on the secondary of that network. You don't just go open up your catalog and buy some diodes that have the right peak and reverse voltage rating and the right current rating to do that. So there's lots of fine little details that can create significant amount of problems. And I think Glenn, you, Mill, and I are saying that a beginner should not do this. This is a fairly advanced project. There's a slim possibility that if the article in QEX that Eric told us about is a well-written article where the guy has torn his hair for 6 months and he's really worked out the problems of 3,000 volt, 60 kilohertz or 100 kilohertz switching spikes and how to get the electromagnetic interference out of that, proper shielding, bypassing, and whatever. If the guy's article has all of those details properly ironed out, and now you're not making a Chinese copy, you're duplicating his article word for word, letter for letter, so to speak. Yes, that can be a successful project. But to start out saying that I'm going to choose this guy's rectifier, this guy's switching network, this guy's thick. Yeah, go ahead.
Don't get me wrong. In the article, he bought someone else's supply specifically designing for amateur service. So, I think in the article he said that the cost of buying the supply was about a little more than the cost of buying the transformer to build it independently.